on Audio, the podcast for writers and all who are interested in books, literature, and the printed word. Write on Audio is the weekly companion podcast of Write On magazine and the Write On suite of publications from Pen to Print. Subscribe by searching Pen to Print in your favourite podcast app to have new editions delivered to you each week. Write On Audio listener contributions, sharing your writing for the world to hear. Our March listener contribution comes from Whitney Love. Whitney's book, She Set Him Up, The Untold Story of a Single Mother, was published in January this year by Troubadour. And for this week's podcast, we're going to hear Whitney reading from the first chapter of the book.
I peel my eye open to glance at the time on my phone. It's 3 a.m. Since midnight, I've been lying in bed, half asleep and half awake, beneath the light of the moon. I sigh in frustration. My mind refuses to rest. Instead, it churns around like a well-oiled machine, replaying conversations that continue to plague me. My pregnancy pillow provides limited comfort. As I close my eyes and I try to sleep, just as you're kicking from inside my womb, you remind me that it's not just me alone with my thoughts. It is us, and you will be here soon. It may seem contrary to say that for many years I never wanted a child. My early life experiences rewired me into believing that bringing a child into this world was a bad idea. I grew up in South London. The girls I saw having babies were young mums struggling, living in social housing and on benefits. I had been a product of a single mother. We too had lived in social housing. My mother always had to work to not, as she saw it, take handouts. My mother would always say, "Don't beg, don't steal and don't borrow." And that was a compass by which she tried to live and encourage the same of me. I have called my mother by her first name, Esther, for as long as I can remember. I recall the first time it was acknowledged. It had obviously tickled her because she laughed from her stomach, a full belly laugh, before responding with, "You're too fresh." Life was not easy for Esther. Even from my childhood perspective, I understood enough to know things were at times strained and I needed to lighten the load by helping. I don't think Esther ever said explicitly that I had to do tasks to help, but I do believe there was an unwritten rule between us, and I just knew what needed to be done. While Esther went to work as a nurse, I would stay home alone. "Don't open the door to no one, you hear me?" she would warn. "Yes, Mum," I would reply using the proper title. I knew by her tone that this was important and that there was no time for foolishness by way of calling her Esther. Once she left the house, I would make myself busy by cleaning it from top to bottom. I would put the dirty clothes in the washing machine and use the wash cycle time to prepare dinner. By the time Esther returned home, there was nothing left for her to do. During that period, I could not have been more than 6 years old. When I reflect on the average six-year-olds today, the contrast could not be more marked. Esther and I worked well as a team. I was proud of us. With time, my assistants afforded me fun opportunities like attending Saturday school for lessons in ballet, tap, modern dance and drama. There may have been other single parents that also took their children to Saturday school, but I didn't know of any. All my friends came from two-parent homes with a mum and a dad who were married. Back then, and perhaps even now, I would say it was unusual for a black child to be allowed to have sleepovers at their friend's house, but I was allowed on several occasions. I'm grateful to Esther for giving me those moments. They meant a lot to me. Those sleepovers are a significant reason for some of the happy memories I have of my childhood. Perhaps unintentionally, they showed me something I could aspire to, a snapshot of how families were supposed to be when at their best. One of my fondest memories is being sat around the dinner table of my friend Hannah's house. We sat together with her mum, dad and brother Josh to a massive serving of my favourite meal, macaroni cheese. Hannah and I spent the whole meal laughing and giggling, so much so that I was unable to control my fits of laughter about goodness knows what. The jovial eruption of giggles made my macaroni that I had in my mouth fly right out of it and find its way on Hannah's dad's plate. I was mortified. I stopped laughing immediately and held my breath in shock and anticipation. But no one flinched or seemed bothered at all. The definite scolding I was expecting never came. No one skipped a beat or paused to acknowledge what happened. It was as if they hadn't even noticed. I recall my amazement that the adults were just happy and very chilled out about our childish shenanigans. That was a breath of fresh air to me. By comparison, had I been home with my dad present? I'll get into how he arrived in my life a little later. And that happened, it would have been a completely different story. In moments like that where I experienced a stark contrast to how things were in my home, I began to idealise being a member of a different family. And for me, because the only positive experiences that I had to draw upon were of my white friends, I began to wish that a white family would adopt me. I've never openly confessed this to anyone, but it was something I held on to for as long as I can remember. As an adult, I now know that you can have good or bad families irrespective of race, colour or creed. But as a child, most of my friends were white, English and middle class. They were the only real life examples I had to compare my family to. Esther and I lived in Dulwich. I was the only black child among my white friends, but there was never any feeling of being different. We were just being. All of us were so perfectly innocent and happy to play and enjoy each other's company. Esther had brought me up to be a respectful child who went to Sunday school and church every Sunday. She was from a French-speaking island in the Caribbean. The use of proper grammar was of high importance and always emphasised by Esther, as was the need to physically present myself in a respectable way. Our clothes were always clean and freshly pressed, face and body creamed, hair oiled. I was a bookworm who was well spoken and had quite a large vocabulary for a young child. Esther played a huge part in that because she would ensure she spoke to me without babying me, in an adult yet child appropriate way. Esther felt it was more useful for me to be well spoken in the English language and focus on expanding my vocabulary. Although she spoke to me in French Creole, she never made a habit of it and would do so sparingly. Esther was born in the warm sun of the Caribbean and had quite a middle class upbringing where she attended an Anglican school. That education was funded by the Anglican Church in England and the educational standard was that of a grammar school in England. Our family were well known on the island. They had obtained good social standing, owning their own home which was built to their specification. In those days, the 1950s, it was quite common to be raised by grandparents or aunts and uncles. Life was no different for Esther. She had a happy childhood surrounded by lots of family with land that was plentiful and fruitful. You could live off the food of their land, and that's exactly what the family did. They had everything growing on the land, from breadfruits to plantains, and they never wanted for anything. Esther's mother, my grandma Charlotte, had emigrated to England in the hope of setting up her career as a nurse. It was common practice that a family member would go to England in pursuit of a better life for their family. What was also common practice was to send money back home to the family to help build the wealth and lifestyles of those back in the Caribbean. If people who came to Britain in search of prosperity didn't already have land or property back home, they would save from the money they made in Britain to put towards building a house back in the Caribbean. Grandma Charlotte's main agenda was to set up a life for her and Esther in England. Soon enough, she had set herself up sufficiently and sent for Esther to come and live with her. Grandma Charlotte had been a single parent. I'm not sure how much of that was by choice, but I do know that her family didn't like Esther's father, and Grandma Charlotte honoured her family by cutting all ties with him. From the stories that I was told about my Grandma Charlotte, it was clear to me she was not average. She was a special woman. With the support of her large family, who all lived together like the Waltons, she began to carve out her own independence with a goal to emigrate to England, where she imagined the streets were paved with gold. Grandma Charlotte was multi-skilled. By the time she set for England, she had secretarial skills and was an excellent seamstress and a qualified midwife. And though I never got to meet her because she fell victim to cancer at the young age of 40, I know she was a very cool grandmother who owned and rode a Vista motorcycle, no less. Esther was 9 years old when Grandma Charlotte sent for her, and she left the Caribbean to live in England. Sadly, it wasn't long after she arrived that Grandma Charlotte died from cancer. All at once, Esther found herself alone, an orphan far away from home in a place she barely knew. Despite her grief, through the years, Esther was determined to pay homage to her mother in one way or another. She worked hard to study and gain qualifications to become a nurse. Of all the things that can be passed down through the bloodline, I'm grateful Grandma Charlotte's strong will was passed on to Esther, and subsequently on to me. But life can continue to be cruel sometimes. The torment it dishes out can be so harsh. Because of the grief of losing her mother at such a young and impressionable age, with no close relatives in England to tend to her brokenness, some years later Esther suffered a breakdown. From then onwards, the shadow of illness would descend over her and cause multiple breakdowns that rendered her useless to herself and to me for long periods of time. During those periods, Esther had to spend time in what she called the mental institution, a large London psychiatric hospital. Watching your mother deteriorate right in front of your eyes is one of the hardest things a child could ever go through. Esther would turn into someone I no longer recognised and could no longer accept as my mother. It was confusing and soul-destroying to bear witness to this illness up close and personal. I learned quickly that all the things she said she could see and hear and would point and stare and respond to only existed inside her imagination. I remember a time when Esther's illness took hold of us both during a night that felt like the longest night ever. It is a night that haunts me even now. I had gone to sleep with Esther, as I so often did. I had taken to sleeping in the bed with Esther because I was afraid of the dark. I was afraid of the monsters that could be hiding within the shadows of my room. But now, instead of the safety and comfort that I longed for, I found myself wide awake inside a nightmare, not knowing if my next breath would be my last. The extra body heat made things real cozy. I liked putting my feet up on Esther's hip, as though it was a footstool when she lay on her side in a fetal position. It felt so comfortable, at least for me, and no matter how much she complained, somehow my little feet found their way back in the same position to rest on the dip of her hip. I wiggled my toes in comfort and quietly giggled to myself victoriously until I slipped into sleep. There are moments in life that leave you with a distinct feeling of inevitability in your bones about the things that are passed on through the bloodline. These unseen things create patterns which repeat themselves throughout generations. Here I am with my mother's shoes firmly on my feet as a single mother. Day and night, I weave through the steep learning curve of looking after a small child alone. It's mind-blowing and exhausting all at once. In a restful moment when you are sound asleep, and I am, of course, wide awake, I smile as I notice you become the child I used to be. Your tiny feet have found themselves upon the nook of my hip, just as mine used to be with Essie. For the first time, I emphasise with how Essie must have felt on those nights all those years ago, with my feet lodged in her hip. Nevertheless, I am assured that you are as happy as I used to be in those moments, and everything feels worth it. Sound asleep, I was snapped back awake to the sound of desperate screams. Help! Help! Somebody's trying to kill us! I'm broken! The screams were so harrowing that my eyes flicked wide open. I jumped right out of my skin. For a moment my vision was blurry, but then it sharpened to focus on the figure I could see a few feet away. It was Esther, leaning out of the open bedroom window in her long white and flowy nightdress that was billowing in the wind like a ghost. My heart was beating faster and louder. I was terrified. My body tensed and my little feet curled. I balled my fist and gripped the sheets, pulling them closer for comfort. But comfort would not come. Within a few seconds, my nightclothes were damp with sweat. But then, just as suddenly as it had begun, Esther's screaming stopped. She calmly turned around from the window as though there was nothing left to be done. As her eyes met mine, she said nonchalantly, "Oh, you're awake?" She turned on her heels, briskly walked over and sat beside me on the bed. Looking straight into my eyes, she said, "They're trying to kill us." Her words stopped my breath for what felt like eternity. Esther's words were so visceral, they crawled around under my skin. I froze as I scattered thoughts continued to spin around and around my head. I noticed I was shaking when my teeth began to chatter. I wished I was dreaming. Bang! 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 This was real. I could hear the thuds at the door and see the door rattle, then settle back into place. This wasn't a figment of Esther's imagination. For the first time, I too could see and hear everything Esther could see and hear. "You see, you didn't believe me, did you? I'm not mad," she said. Then the door stopped rattling. Esther and I huddled on the bed with only silence between us. And then, bang, bang! "This is the police," I heard a man say alongside the crackling of his radio. I let out an audible sigh of relief. The rest of that night is a blur, but the police did confirm that they found no signs of forced entry. How can I explain what I saw and heard that night? The door, the banging. Perhaps they were nothing more than a hallucination resulting from extreme stress of witnessing Esther's outburst and tapping into her fear. I wonder whether I too could become ill like Esther. That thought terrifies me. I reason with myself and concede that hallucinating was a one-off incident that occurred under duress, and I have tried to bury it into the deepest corner of my mind. I have drawn the conclusion that there is a stark difference between Esther and me in terms of our approach to mental health. I'm open to help should I need it, and I sought help during my own depressive episode that occurred many years later. Esther, on the other hand, was undeniably anti anyone who would even dare question she was anything but in her right mind.
Thank you to Whitney Love for sharing the first chapter of her book, She Set Him Up, which is published by Troubadour. We'll share a link so you can find out more about the book and purchase a copy direct from the publisher in our show notes. We're always delighted to read your contributions, so if you'd like to see your words in Write On or hear them on this podcast, please get in touch. We'll share this link and all others mentioned in today's podcast as part of our show notes. I've been Tiffany Clare, and you've been listening to Write on Audio. Write on Audio is produced by Chris Gregory, and it's an alternative stories production for pen to print. This podcast is supported using public funding by Arts Council England.